Coming up on Boston Public Radio, he was sentenced to 8 years in jail 2 years ago. Now he's got cancer and is hundreds of miles away from home. Has former House Speaker Sal DeMacy suffered enough? He runs the state lottery, the most successful in the nation. But will casinos change all that? The head of the lottery joins us to take your questions. And then, it's August, and candy corn is on shelves everywhere. And before you know it, it'll be Christmas carols 24/7. We'll ask, can't we experience the present before we're deluged with the future? Can't we, Marjorie?
No, Jim, we can't.
Okay.
Christopher Lydon joins us on 20 Feet from Stardom, this fantastic documentary on backup singers to, among others, Sting, the Rolling Stones, Bruce Springsteen, then Kara Miller on the Third Industrial Revolution, and, quote-unquote, perceptive radio. What's that? Stay tuned to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. A military judge is allowing the self-confessed Fort Hood shooter to continue defending himself over the objections of his standby attorneys. The lawyers who've been helping Major Nidal Hassan represent himself during his court-martial at the Texas base say they'll appeal. They argue Hassan is intentionally working toward a conviction and a death sentence. The Army psychiatrist is charged with murdering 13 and the attempted murder of 32 others in the 2009 attack. Hassan was also shot and paralyzed during the rampage. Prosecutors are asking an expert on violent Islamist extremism to help them show that Army Private Bradley Manning compromised U.S. interests when he leaked a trove of classified information to the anti-secrecy website WikiLeaks. Navy Commander Yusuf Abul Anin testifies today at Manning's sentencing hearing in Maryland's Fort Meade. The 25-year-old could get up to 90 years in prison. President Obama will meet with the Prime Minister of Greece at the White House today. NPR's Ari Shapiro reports they'll discuss economic and foreign policy issues.
This meeting comes just a couple of weeks after Treasury Secretary Jack Lew visited Athens. The White House says the two leaders today will discuss American support for Greek economic reform efforts. The International Monetary Fund recently warned that Greece will need billions more in bailouts over the next couple of years. Greece already owes its European creditors hundreds of billions of euros. The country has promised to cut thousands of civil service jobs to keep the bailout money coming. Beyond economic issues, the leaders are likely to discuss security issues in the region. Syria's civil war is high on that list, along with unrest in Egypt and Turkey. Ari Shapiro, NPR News, Washington.
Afghans are celebrating the first day of the Muslim Eid holiday, as are Muslims around the world. But in Afghanistan, it is no holiday from violence. At least 14 women and children are dead following a bomb blast in the eastern part of the country. NPR's Sean Carberry reports that many of the victims were visiting the grave of a family member at the time of the explosion.
Officials say the bomb was planted in a cemetery and detonated as women and children were picnicking near the grave of a relative, which is a common ritual during the first day of the Eid holiday. Several other women and children were injured in the blast. Militants have carried out several attacks as the holy month of Ramadan comes to a close. Gunmen ambushed the vehicle of a female senator, wounding her and killing her 8-year-old daughter. And the chief of police in Helmand province has survived a blast targeting his convoy. In his message marking the start of Eid, President Karzai urged the Taliban to lay down their weapons and join the political process. Sean Carberry, NPR News, Kabul.
Jurors are deliberating for a third day in James Whitey Bulger's racketeering trial. The reputed Boston mob boss faces dozens of charges, including taking part in 19 murders. Dow's off slightly. This is NPR News.
Good afternoon from the WGBH Radio Newsroom in Boston. I'm Christina Quinn with the local stories we're following. Deliberations are into a third day in the racketeering trial of James Whitey Bulger. The panel yesterday had a series of legal questions, including whether or not they had to make unanimous findings on each of the 33 criminal acts included in a racketeering charge. Those 33 acts include 19 murders. Judge Denise Casper told jurors they had to be unanimous on whether prosecutors have proven or not proven each act, but she also told them they could choose to make no finding on certain acts if they cannot agree. Secretary of State William Galvin has been ordered to cover more than $100,000 in legal fees for a group of lobbyists who challenged his interpretation of the state's revamped ethics laws. A judge found that Galvin overstepped his authority by trying to force lobbyists to report every time they spoke to a legislator or state official, even casual chance meetings. Galvin says he's disappointed with the decision and may appeal. A court in New Bedford has abandoned its new dress code that said no to bare midriffs, excessive cleavage, and tank tops. The judge who implemented the policy tells the New Bedford Standard Times that the code was dropped because of the lack of a unified policy for all state courts. Rhode Island Attorney General Peter Kilmartin says the state has closed on a 52-acre Narragansett Indian archaeological site in Narragansett, preserving the property and compensating for a damage a state construction project will do to another archaeological site in Providence. The Providence Journal reports archaeologists say the site at the head of Point Judith Pond, and referred to as the Salt Pond site, is one of the most significant on the East Coast. The Narragansett tribe has identified Salt Pond as a place of cultural and spiritual importance to the tribe. Support for NPR comes from Zurich Insurance, providing risk management and insurance solutions to help businesses meet their ever-changing needs. Learn more at ZurichNA.com. The Red Sox take on the Royals in Kansas City tonight, and the weather forecast for this afternoon, mostly cloudy with a chance of showers and thunderstorms, highs around 80. At 12:06, it's 75 degrees in Brighton. I'm Christina Quinn, WGBH News.
From a transmitter atop Great Blue Hill, this is WGBH, live, local talk. Boston Public Radio.
He's Jim Browdy. I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH.
Hey there, Marjorie.
Hey, Jim.
Sal DeMacy was the third Massachusetts House Speaker in a row to be found guilty of a felony, but unlike his two predecessors, he was sentenced to jail. 8 years. But almost 2 years in, he suffers from throat and tongue cancer, can hardly speak, and is hundreds of miles away from his family in North Carolina. Is it time to show DeMacy some mercy? Has he suffered enough? I'll ask you that question in a minute. But first, we're joined by a man who's been making the case for mercy. He's a veteran State House reporter, columnist for the Lowell Sun, Peter Lucas. Peter, thanks so much for joining us.
Hello, Jim. Hello, Marjorie.
Hey, Peter. Great to talk to you. You wrote a terrific piece about showing some compassion to Sal DeMacy. Why'd you do it? And what'd you say?
Well, I did it because I've known Sal DeMacy for a long time. And let me tell you, I've been covering the legislature for many years. He is not the worst person to come out of here. I've seen guys that have worked at the State House that I was convinced should be in jail. Sal was not one of them. He was a terrific guy, a good legislator, took care of his constituency, but he made a mistake, and he paid for it. I do think that 8 years for a man in his condition was way too stiff of a sentence.
And by the way, longest in Massachusetts history for a political corruption case. But go ahead, Peter.
He had a heart condition when he went in and asked to be sent to Fort Devens. He was sent to Kentucky instead. He developed a severe cancer condition in his throat, and he got inadequate attention, inadequate medical care, was dragged before a grand jury, was made a spectacle. He was treated worse than you'd treat a prisoner at Gitmo. In fact, I think they're treated better down there. And I always thought that since his condition being what it was, that the government should at least show him some compassion and mercy and at least get him transferred back here. It's not that I'm, you know, asking that he be on the cover of Rolling Stone magazine or anything like that. But I do think he should be given a fair shake.
And we should say, Peter, for a little bit of background, the judge who sentenced him in this case recommended to the Bureau of Prisons that he be somewhere close to home for a variety of reasons. But they rejected that recommendation. And as you say, now he is hundreds of miles away. When his family visits him, from what I understand from a column you wrote and others, he occasionally cannot even see them because he's so ill, and he can't speak to them because of the cancer in his tongue.
And he has a feeding tube.
And his throat.
In his stomach.
You know, go back to, I'm sorry, Marjorie, go ahead.
I was going to say, Peter, you've been a reporter for a long time. I was stunned by the DeMacy, not so much the sentencing. I think you mentioned this last night. I saw you on Jim's television show on NACN. I think DeMacy was paying for the sins of other people, the first two speakers that did not serve any jail time. Fairly or unfairly, he is. But the incredible thing that you have the judge saying, put this man in Devens, where, of course, the younger alleged bomber in the marathon is. He's in Devens. Put him close to his family. And they send him to Kentucky. The Bureau of Prisons just ignores the judge. And we don't get any explanation from them. We, the citizens asking these questions, it's just, this is where we're putting him. Shut up.
No, there is no explanation. None at all. In fact, the family hasn't even got an explanation. And it's not as though the family were lobbying me or anything like that to write anything about it. I haven't even talked to the family. However, the injustice of it all, when I compare it to the situations of other people caught up in the criminal justice system, say, for instance, John Marano, who was confessed to killing 20 people. He served 12 years in prison. That's less than a year for every murder. He's out now, doing quite well financially, with a book, a movie contract, and so on. It just seems to me totally unfair.
You know, the conventional wisdom is one of the reasons they gave him a runaround before they realized how sick he was because they wanted to convince him, we'll be nice to you if it turns out you're nice to us when we call you before a grand jury on the so-called probation scandal on Beacon
Don't
Hill.
Get me started. Don't get me started on the probation.
well, you know, but that may explain.
Listen,
go ahead, Peter.
They dragged a sick Zell DeMacy up here to testify. The U.S. attorney was trying to find out, was convinced that politicians on Beacon Hill got jobs for people at the probation department in exchange for money, for bribes, okay? Now, they called more than 50 legislators to this grand jury, which went on for almost 2 years, trying to prove that crimes were committed. Do you know how many indictments she came up with, the U.S. attorney?
Well, we know how many indictments of politicians she came up with. Obviously, the head of probation, O'Brien. But, Peter, I want to work back with you for a second. When we spoke last night, and from having read your column, you also think that the stiffness of the sentence wasn't just, as Marjorie suggested, a sort of a payback for two previous felonious speakers who did no jail time, Tom Finneran and Charlie Flaherty, but also because of other politicians who'd been sentenced to jail right before this, correct?
Yes, well, there were two African-American politicians who were sent to jail, Chuck Turner, a Boston City Councilman, and State Senator Diane Wilkinson, both for taking bribes. And they both were sent to jail, Turner for 1 year and Wilkinson for three. And there were a lot of people around who felt that, black folks go to jail, but white folks don't. There's sort of racism involved. That was in the air. And if Sal DeMacy was convicted and got no jail time, that would prove racism exists in the court system. That was hanging in the air also, as well as the fact that his two previous speakers were indicted and convicted.
You know, Peter, Marjorie and I were talking before the show. We're talking about for people in jail who've done things far worse than Sal DeMacy ever dreamed of. And I should say, in the spirit of full disclosure, I did think he should do some jail time. I thought eight was a long time. But there are people who've done far worse than he has, where there are organized campaigns to get them clemency or commutation or at least back near their families. There's no organized anything for DeMacy, is there?
No, there is no organization, no group out to help Sal DeMacy. I'm surprised at the total lack of public compassion that's been shown by his former peers up at the Massachusetts House of Representatives and the Senate, as well as the governor. They've sort of turned their cold shoulder on Sal. I think part of the reason is they're afraid. They're afraid of retribution from the U.S. attorney or maybe even the attorney general. It's a difficult time. It's a difficult time for politicians to raise their hands or their heads up above sea level because they're liable to get it chopped off.
Yeah, well, I am surprised by Governor Deval Patrick, who I generally think of as a compassionate guy. When he was asked about this, he said he wasn't going to get involved in that. And when he was asked how come, you got all this in your column, Peter, he says, because it's not my jurisdiction. I have plenty of other things to do. Any other questions? This was kind of a flip remark to John Keller from WBZ TV. It kind of surprised me that he would react this way. And the other thing that I think this story points out, Peter Lucas, is that if Sal DeMacy discovers, or actually his wife, Debbie DeMacy, who's had cancer issues herself, discovers that her husband has what she thinks is a lump on his neck, and they drive him halfway across the country for days and days and days before he gets it really seriously checked, how else are prisoners who aren't Sal DeMacy, who are just Joe Schmo in the federal prisons, treated? It's a really frightening window into the Bureau of Prisons' sort of lack of compassion for the people. I know they're prisoners, but still, you want to give them basic health care.
The governor is a compassionate man. There's no doubt about it. However, there are times when his compassion is very selective. He's pretty good when it comes to a rapist up in doing life up in Walpole.
Oh, that was Ben Laguerre. Yes.
But in fair way, but Peter, in fairness to the governor, as soon as there was a DNA test that came back that showed that the Laguerre was connected to the rape that he said he was wrongly convicted for, Patrick abandoned him. But you were right. Up until that time, he and John Silber were part of the chorus saying this guy was done wrong.
Jim, the governor has shown more compassion for illegal immigrants, for people who are on sex changes, than he has ever for Sal. And I think there's a reason for it. Don't forget, the governor was a prosecution witness in Sal DeMacy's corruption case. Also, the governor has to feel a little twinge of guilt involved because he approved the Cognos computer contract that Sal extorted for $65,000.
Yeah, but that is factually true, Peter. But Peter, he didn't get $65,000 kickback or bribe to approve it.
The governor later rescinded it.
Mm-hmm, that's correct.
His approval. And also, at that time, when Sal was opposing the governor on the casino legislation, the governor's people were dropping dimes left and right to the Globe and the Globe Spotlight team on Sal. They played a very active role in bringing Sal down. I'm not saying they set out to get him, indicted and convicted. No. But they leaked a lot of stuff on Sal DeMacy. That hurt him very much.
You know, let me just say, Peter, as I said to you last night, based on the evidence I saw, not as a juror, I thought that Sal DeMacy had broken the law. I thought it was reasonable to send them to jail for a short period of time. But I have to say, I've not heard one argument from anyone as to why, at minimum, if he's to continue to serve jail time in this kind of condition, why he is not somewhere in Massachusetts where his wife and stepkids can visit him. And I think it's great you've championed this. And, Peter, it's great to talk to you. Thank you so much for your time. We appreciate it.
Okay, guys. Thank you.
Thank you, Peter.
Peter Lucas. You know, and one of the interesting things here, Marjorie, is one of the great ironies. And let me be clear, I'm not at all urging mercy here because I think he didn't do anything. He did something. He broke the law. He committed a felony.
Right.
He should have been punished. But the notion that he was denied health care, a guy who helped bring universal health care, by the way, talk of ironies, to Massachusetts and the nation, is insane. So we want to know at 877-301-8970, where are you on this? The final editorial in the Boston Phoenix before it closed. Remember the last line? It says he was sentenced to 8 years, not sentenced to death.
Right.
And they, and then the Globe a few days earlier, were arguing for either commutation or at minimum bringing this guy back home. And, you know, I asked, I don't know if it was here or elsewhere, I asked a top law enforcement official about putting someone far away from their family. And what they said to me without any equivocation, unless you're a member of a gang, the rule of thumb is you put a prisoner somewhere near their friends and family because it helps with rehabilitation when they get out of this.
Listen, this is part of a whole bigger picture, which is getting more and more annoying to me as a reporter and as a citizen, is that the federal government lately has been doing whatever it wants in a lot of areas and just telling us, too bad, we don't have to answer any questions. That's the way it is. And I find it really upsetting in the case of Sal DeMacy, particularly when you look at the fact that his wife, Debbie DeMacy, who herself has had breast cancer and has dealt with her health issues, said that it was months before they diagnosed him with cancer, months. And she noticed that he had a swelling in his neck 2 months after he began his sentence. And they did nothing.
When she was visiting him
in
Kentucky.
Yes, and they did nothing about it. It's like I said before, it's a terrible window into what prisoners may endure. He's a fairly high-profile guy. And the fact that the judge himself says sentence him close to home because of his health issues and his wife's health issues. So as it is, he's now in North Carolina. But before that, you'd have to, if you're a family member, you've got to fly down to Kentucky to see him. In what is the point of that? We have a facility right here in Massachusetts in Devens. There is no point to it. It's just sort of a kind of a drop dead to the citizenry and a drop dead to Sal DeMacy. I'd also like to point out that Catherine Grieg, who helped Whitey Bulger in his being on the lam for all those years, she got 8 years in jail as well, which is the same thing as Sal DeMacy got. And you could argue that her help to Whitey was much more significant than what Sal DeMacy did.
Well,
also,
I think you could argue, as Peter Lucas did, that Martirano killing 20 people
right.
and doing 12 years and now collecting Social Security in Cambridge.
And may we add to that list Kevin Weeks, who was an associate of Whitey Bulger, who got 5 years for assisting with these murders and burying bodies and pulling out teeth of people and all these gruesome things. You get the sense that the justice is so arbitrary, if there's any justice at all, and it's very frustrating.
877-301-8970. He's less than 2 years into his 8-year sentence. He's, I believe, in Butler, North Carolina, in some federal detention health hospital facility. Is the time at minimum to allow him to come home to be near his family? And even further, a lot of people arguing that he deserves some commutation of his sentence by the president. And by the way, if people don't know, and I believe this was in the Phoenix story, of recent presidents, the president who has shown least interest by far in commutations of sentences is Barack Obama. 877-301-8970. What do you think should happen to Sal DeMacy? A lot of people think you do the crime, you got to be able to do the time. Ryan in Boston, you were next on Boston Public Radio. Jim and Marjorie, thanks for the call, Ryan.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. I just want to say that over 2,500 men and women die of chronic diseases and cancers in the prison system, and most of them are away from their families too. But none of them took an oath to uphold the Constitution of the state on behalf of every person who lives here. And most of them don't have families who can even afford to go to North Carolina and visit the family members in prison there. So I think it's a little, I don't know, I think it's wrong to kind of boo-hoo for people who are pretty well off and did a serious crime when there are people who've done way worse and suffer a lot more.
So your view is he was sentenced 8 years. If he didn't want to do it, he shouldn't have done what he did to get himself put in jail.
He got off pretty easy betraying every person in Massachusetts and only getting 8 years in prison for it.
Ryan, I
guess the issue to me is, why is anybody thousands of miles from their family? No one should be. I mean, if you can,
unless you're gang members,
if you're worried about your gangs coming down or influencing you in prison, I suppose that's one thing. But except for that, and I'm not even sure I agree with that, I don't get the idea why anybody should be that far away from home and their family. Jerry in the car, what do you think, Jerry?
Well, I'd like to preface my remarks about the Al DeMacy by asking Favencia not to put a Haitian curse on me for what I'm about to say. I think Sal DeMacy deserves to do as much time as possible. We put this man in charge to save us money on our taxes and be responsible and be a great politician and show some leadership. But, of course, you know, we live in Massachusetts. We're run by liberal Democrats, and this is what we get. And now that he got caught with his fingers in the cookie jar, the stupid dummy, hey, he deserves what he gets. And I got no sympathy for him. It's in the dictionary in between excrement and syphilis.
We got it. Jerry, thank you for the call. Well, obviously, there's no movement to grant some mercy for Sal DeMacy. Let me tell you.
I'm getting some emails to the contrary. Sure. Judith just emailed. She wants to release this man, absolutely, which is even more. And we have another question about contact information for the Board of Prisons. We should get that on our website, actually, to find out how you can complain or express your views on the Sal DeMacy situation.
Can I tell you another thing that I think, this is total speculation, but since Peter was speculating, and I agree with the speculation, that part of the reason for the severe sentence was not just the crime itself, but as you said, because of two felonious speakers who didn't go to jail,
right,
because two African-American politicians had gone to jail,
right,
there's a powerful white guy going to go. The third reason, I don't know Mark Wolf at all, and I am told he is a totally honorable, great, he's now a retired judge, is when virtually every liberal in Massachusetts, despite what Sal DeMacy had been convicted of, and despite not testifying in his own defense, remember he went to outside the courthouse, the Moakley Courthouse, mm-hmm, afterwards, and essentially stated his defense after the cameras, after he was convicted. My attitude was, if you had something to say, you should have said it when the jury still had a chance to acquit you. Virtually every liberal in Massachusetts came to his defense saying what I consider to be relevant in terms of mitigation, but they didn't think he should do any time. Their view was he was, again, stop casinos, responsible for universal health care, a long litany of important developments, but totally ignoring the fact that, as this prior caller, Jerry, had said, he completely betrayed the public trust. He was convicted of that. If those liberals had been more grounded and said, in light of the good things he does, his sentence should be modest, not severe.
I think the issue,
maybe it wouldn't have been severe.
The issue is Sal DeMacy or anybody who is unlucky enough, or they do the crime and so they're convicted and they go to jail, who goes to a federal prison, should get immediate care for their possible cancer. A murderer. If you murdered 50 people, Whitey Bulger should be getting taken care of in prison.
Don't you remember he's rushed to a hospital one day?
Taken care of very well. Everybody should get that kind of care in prison. And the other thing is, like I said, you should be, if possible, close to your family.
By the way, you quoted Peter's thing about Jahar Tsarnaev is in Devens.
He's in Devens.
Yeah, but that's not a fair comparison. He's in Devens because he's on trial. I mean, you don't know what's going to happen to him after the assuming
he's convicted. Really matter. His parents are in Russia.
I understand.
He's got family.
His
friends. He's got sisters here.
Well, coach, didn't we read that his coach should visit him? And I think we did when he was arraigned. Let's take a few more here. Carol, you're in Scituate. You're on with Jim and Marjorie. We're talking about Sal DeMacy's prison term. Hey, Carol.
Hi. I just wanted to say I worked with at the winery on the waterfront in Boston in my 20s. I'm in my 50s now.
Yep.
And Sal was a regular there, and I never saw such a kind, generous person. He, at one point, helped someone get a wheelchair. We had a lot of elderly clients come in and out of there. He used to leave cash at the desk for a lady who took the train every day from Quincy. He used to always make sure we gave her a to-go bag, and he was always out there helping the elderly.
But, Carol, even though obviously the end of your sentence is, I assume you're saying we should show him some mercy, were you amongst those who thought after he's convicted that he shouldn't do any jail time at all?
No, I think a short jail time was definitely fine, but I think we treated our coward, killer, terrorist better than we did Sal DeMacy.
Carol, thanks for the call and thanks for the personal recollection. Let's take one more quick one. In Lexington, Robert is on Boston Public Radio with Jim and Marjorie. Thanks for the call, Robert.
It's good to hear you guys, and I'm so glad that you're with us still.
So are we.
Needless to say.
We are too, Robert. Thanks.
Awesome. Anyway, first of all, I basically agree that Mr. DeMacy should be shown some consideration because of his health. But Marjorie is correct that so should maybe anyone in a similar situation. But I mostly want to go back to Mr. Lucas, who talked about someone else's selective compassion.
The governor.
The governor. I think we could maybe put that on him. I suffered through some of his columns in the Lowell Sun from time to time. But I mean, he also should get some of his facts straight. He said that the two Boston politicians,
Wilkerson and
one in 3 years. I thought maybe one of you would have corrected
him. It's 3 years.
Mr. Turner just got out after doing most of his 3 years.
Got 3 years. You're
over $1,000, and I think Wilkerson has gone away for 5 or 7 years. And by the way,
she's three as well, I think. But go ahead, Robert.
No, I don't think so. I think it's longer than three. I'm going to say six.
Well, go ahead.
So all I'm saying is DeMacy's crime to me, and I guess I could say I'm a liberal Democrat, is extremely serious. I find it appalling that someone in his position and his stature was basically extorting companies, or extorted this company.
Yeah.
I'm sure it was probably the first time he ever did anything like that. But, you know, he committed a very serious crime and really breached the confidence of people in state government and probably, you know, in the Democratic Party. That other gentleman was bashing all Democrats because of these people. And
well, I don't think the Democratic Party is as relevant as his, you know, the trust that he was given by the people. But Robert, so we'll make you the head of the Bureau of Prisons for the next 15 seconds. What do you do with this guy based upon all you've said?
I would move him to Devens, and I would have the judicial, I would have parole or probation, review whether he should be, whether his physical condition is such that he should be released. But in no way, shape, or form do I have any mercy in terms of what he did. What he did is extremely serious. I just can't imagine someone, you know, pocketing $65,000 over a state contract, someone in his position. I mean,
there's more to this. But not only, Robert, if I may, not only did he get $65,000 in a bribe, but he, as a result of that bribe, $15 million of our money, yours, mine, Marjorie's, and other listeners, was given to a company because of their connection to him. And I'm not. There's a corollary issue. Robert, we're really glad to hear from you. Thank you so much for the call.
I just want to be clear on this. Diane Wilkerson was sentenced to 3.5 years for taking 23,500. $500 in bribes.
That was the bra stuffing.
Yes, it was a famous picture of her on the front page of the Boston Herald stuffing cash in her bra. But the irony of the Sal DeMasi case, and I've never understood this, is Sal DeMasi, who was Speaker of the House. How long was he Speaker of the House for?
I don't know.
Well, anyway, he could have left the speakership and done what everybody else does on Beacon Hills and become a lobbyist and make three times that amount of money as a lobbyist, and I never understood.
Three times? How about 30 times?
Well, whatever. He could have become a wealthy man.
Just
a
waited
lobbyist.
A year or resigned
yes,
or something. Yeah.
And I never understood why he just could not have waited. But anyway, that's just me. Peter Lucas, whom we spoke to earlier, he's a State House reporter, and he writes a political column for the Lowell Sun. Years ago, he wrote one for the Boston Herald.
Yes, he did.
As well. Up next, the $448 million Powerball jackpot, the third largest ever, will be split among three winning tickets, one in Minnesota and two in New Jersey. That means nobody here, Jim, got anything. But even though no one did in Massachusetts win, Massachusetts does rank the highest in the nation when it comes to annual lottery spending. What else is there to learn about the lottery? That conversation is up next, 89.7 WGBH.
Next time on Radiolab.
What is there in human nature that allows an individual to act inhumanely, harshly, severely?
Why did you do this? Why did you inflict all this suffering on them, on us? Why?
It was not my personal affair. I had to do what I was ordered.
Does everybody at some point have something dark in them that just tiptoes out, just from time to time?
Tonight at 10, here on WGBH Radio.
WGBH programs exist because of you. And the Boston Speaker Series, presented by Lesley University, featuring a prime minister, a Pulitzer Prize winner, a humorist, and a former spy. More info at bostonspeakerseries.org. Media support from WGBH and Dedham Savings. And Boston Children's Hospital. With suburban locations, affiliate hospitals, and over 400 pediatricians throughout Massachusetts, their community of care is always close at hand. Boston Children's Hospital. Until every child is well.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browder. She is Marjorie Egan. He runs the most successful lottery in America, returning, I believe, a higher percentage of ticket sales to city and towns than any other state lottery. And by the way, we bet more on the lottery than any citizenry in America. So every week we have a public official in Studio 3 to take your calls. Fresh off the third largest Powerball jackpot ever, we welcome to the studio the executive director of the lottery, Paul Sternberg. Paul, good to see you again.
Good to see you as well.
Hi, Paul. Thank you very much for being here. So I'm dying to know, what's going to happen we're still arguing about all these things, but the million-dollar question, literally, when the casinos come to town, what's that going to mean for the lottery? Because you have done very well, giving back money to the cities and towns.
You know, we just had two great years, record-breaking years sales-wise, and in general fund, it was the best 2 years we've had so far. Last year was $983 million. This year was $952 million. So we've been doing very well. Sales have been increasing. And we expect when the casinos come into play, we will take a little bit of a hit, anywhere from 3% to 10%, and those are the experts' estimates.
Yeah, but you know, I've read all those estimates. I've had this discussion we have had with the governor, with your boss, the treasurer, Steve Grossman. But the one variable that those other states don't have is we don't just have the highest per capita lottery playing in the country. We have by far. I have never seen statistics like this. The last time I looked at it, we bet every man, woman, and child, or every adult, whatever it is, in this state, bet roughly twice as much as the second heaviest playing lottery citizenry in the country. How did that happen in this puritanical state of Massachusetts, really?
And that's a great question, and you are correct. It's 2 to 1 per capita. And
I also of the number two. Of the number two, not of the average, of number two. Go ahead.
No, I mean, and it's been a great success story over the 41 years, and part of it is that we have the highest payout in the country. I mean, this past year, we paid out 72.7%. I think the next
closest, To the players, yeah.
Almost 73 cents of every dollar that's wagered goes back to the players in prize money.
Right.
And that's by far probably 7 or 8 points higher than the next closest lottery, which I believe is Missouri. So that's part of our success. Our players know they're the winners there. They enjoy the games that we do. We spend a lot of time in developing the tickets. There are algorithms that develop for the prize structure. So a lot of work and time goes into it. And we pay attention to focus groups. We do research. We do online research. And we try to give the players what they want. So,
question, Paul, is not only for you. And by the way, our number is 877-301-8970. If you have any questions or comments for the executive director of the most successful lottery in America, which would be Massachusetts, what I'm saying is when you guys look at all these other studies of other states that have a casino and a lottery, those other states may have a casino and a lottery, but they don't have a casino and a lottery where people are spending this kind of dough. There's only so much money you can get out of a stone or a human, for lack of a better expression. So my fear, and I have to say in the spirit of full disclosure, I'm not crazy about casinos, but putting that aside, it is what it is. My fear is that casinos will do great, and it's going to cannibalize the lottery far greater than you guys think it is.
I think, and you make a great point, that our per capita is so high that there's only so many discretionary dollars to go around. So at some point, you're going to break the straw that breaks the camel's back. However, I think when you take a look at the two, casinos and lottery together, and looking at the studies and looking at the tax ramifications of 15,000 employees, the net, the two will add up to more than one. In other words, the lottery will do so much, the casino will do so much, but when you put two together, the two together, overall the state will benefit from that. We expect, as I say, to take a hit because, as Jim was pointing out, that the discretionary dollars of what's being spent, how much more can you go? I mean,
right.
We're more than 2-1. Where is that money going to come from? You know, Foxwoods, 40% of their business is from Massachusetts. At some point,
is it 40%?
At 40%. So
wow.
You're expecting at some point the straw is, you know, as I said, the camel's back is going to break. But we expect with more advertising dollars, keeping our portfolio fresh, coming up with new ideas or strategies you can do to compete with casinos.
I don't want to complain about the small stuff here, but as long as you're here, Paul,
okay.
I will.
She has a ticket that she can't find.
No,
what is it?
You know when you go into the 7-Eleven?
Yes.
And you're there to buy a pack of gum or a quart of milk, and there's someone in front of you.
This is not his fault.
Who's buying, like, you know, 27 lottery tickets. I know it's not your fault, but does anybody give any thought to sort of that annoyance factor out there, somehow speeding up the process or something? Well, I'll take two of those, and then I'll take four of those.
My 7-Eleven or whatever it is, Tedeschi's, has a separate line. You have a lottery line, and you have a milk and soda line.
I think that would be a great improvement, but I think a lot of them do not have the separate lines. And some of us are a little quart of milk. We get frustrated. You know what I'm saying, Paul?
Right, and we're taking a look at that, and we've just come out.
You
with,
are?
We are. Actually, it's a valid point. Remember, we're running on a system that's 17 years old.
Right.
So it's a 21st century lottery running with a 20th century technology, you know, technology and what we have out there. However, when the new terminals come in and the new back end comes in, we expect to be much quicker and hopefully allow some self-play. We're doing it right now with our vending machines. We call them PATs, which are player-activated terminals. And we're putting out about 350 in the field where you can actually buy instant tickets, but also play your draw games, Mega Box, Mega Million. So we're looking for ways to speed it up, make it more user-friendly. But it's a valid point. I see people waiting in line.
It's not a valid point.
It's a valid point.
Paul Sternberg, you're not allowed to play, are you?
I am not allowed
okay.
to play.
Oh, that's too bad.
Now I've lost my train of thought. 877-301-8970.
Why don't you ask what you always ask about?
Actually,
Chelsea.
No, here it is. No,
and versus Weston.
Years and years ago. What time were you? When did you become head of the lottery?
I'd be about a little over 2 years.
Okay,
coming up on three.
Tom Birmingham, before he was the, I'm sure you're familiar with the study. Tom Birmingham, before he was the Senate president years ago, he was the chair of the Senate Oversight, Audit, whatever committee, and he did, at least for me, the first comprehensive analysis I'd ever seen of who plays the lottery. That's the first time I ever saw that we were by far number one. But what it also showed was that in places like Chelsea and Holyoke, some of the poorest communities in the state, the amount bet is far above the average. And in places like Dover and Weston, it's far below the average. And the conclusion, and I don't want to put words in Birmingham's mouth, so I'll say it was my conclusion, but I think his too, that in some cases we essentially have people in Chelsea funding schools through the lottery in places like Weston, some of the wealthiest communities. So there is that sort of reverse Robin Hood kind of thing. Is there not, Paul Sternberg?
I would disagree with that because lottery...
How come you agree with her and you don't agree with me?
Well,
go ahead,
she
Paul,
made a better
sorry.
Point at the time.
I did.
Yes. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
In Weston, I believe there's one or two stores that sell lottery. And if you look at the zip codes, for example, in the financial district in Boston, those zip codes have some of our highest play. So what's going on is people play where they work.
Where they work.
Not only where they live. So there is a little bit, obviously, what you said, you do have a point, however.
When the wealthier people play less than poor people, right? That is true.
Well, 85% of the population played at least once last year, played the lottery. So I would take a look at that way and say more people play where they work than where they live. And there are more studies that need to be done to take a look at that.
I have another theory,
right now,
Jim.
Okay. What's that?
If you're living in Chelsea, you're playing the lottery because you're hoping and dreaming that you're going to strike it rich. If you're living in Weston and Dover, your dreams will come true.
Okay, fine. 877-301-8970. We're going to get to the calls in a second. I remember what my question was. Steve Grossman, your boss again, the treasurer, was talking about online. What's the status of being able to buy lottery tickets online? No one's ever going to be able to go to work when this happens. What's the deal, Paul Sterber?
Can you imagine?
Yes, wow.
What's the deal, Paul?
Right now is legal to sell online.
Is legal?
It's illegal.
Illegal, okay.
There is a bill in committee right now, and it did not come out in this session. Maybe it'll come out in the next session. And we would need two changes in the law. One, to be able to bet on credit, and two, to be able to bet over phone lines. So we need that to change.
Is this a federal problem or a state issue?
It's a state issue.
State issue,
the
okay.
feds have ruled that it's okay to sell online for lotteries. 2 years ago around Christmas time, I think it was December 23rd, they came up with a ruling that you could sell online. Lotteries were allowed to sell online in state. So we have to wait for the legislature to act. We will not do that. We can't do it. It's illegal to do it without them. If they ask us to do it, we will gladly do it. It has to be done. You have to look at all the things that will be affected. One would be retailers. Two would be the playing public. And three would be problem gambling. And the treasurer has been very clear about this, and I agree with him 100%. We need to make sure our retailers aren't harmed. We have to make sure the people who have problems are getting the help that they need. You have to put time out. You would have to limit what they could play. So there are a lot of things. Actually, you could control it better online than in the store, because in the store, we can't control who was playing. But if you play online, we could say you can only bet $100
right.
a day. You need to take time out so you don't get to that repetitive gambling point. So there are things that can be done online that you couldn't do in the store. But
can you buy lottery tickets on a credit card now?
No, you cannot.
7-Eleven, so it's all cash.
It's all cash. It's illegal. You could use debit cards if you wanted to, but it's illegal to bet online, to bet with credit.
Let's take a few calls.
That's probably a very good idea. It's going to make it more difficult if people can bet online with credit cards, I think.
Yeah.
Even if you do limit it, you think?
It would definitely, but you can set limits, which is the most important thing, which we can't right now set in the stores. So.
Imagine if you were betting $100 a day, you'd be out of money by the end of the week, right?
That's a very good point, Marjorie. It's excellent mathematics on your part.
Thank 877, you. That's why I'm here.
Unless you live in Weston. 877-301-8970. We're talking to Paul Sternberg. He's the executive director of the lottery. He'll be with us for the next 15 or 20 minutes to answer your questions and ours.
Paul, on the road. Thank you for calling Boston Public Radio. What's up, Paul?
Hey, Jim. Hi, Marjorie. Hi,
hi.
Paul.
Hey.
Great topic. Thank you for bringing it up. I love that you already touched on it, Marjorie, that it is an inconvenience standing behind the people.
You're with me, Paul.
20 tickets. Oh, my God. I'm so with you. So with you. It's terrible. I mean, even just if they could put up a sign that says, please expedite your lottery purchase. Have it ready before you get to the counter, just like they have at Dunkin' Donuts with having your money with.
Exactly.
Yes.
Also, I don't know, are there controls against problem gambling currently in the state?
In the lottery itself, it would be impossible to enforce with 7,400 retailers. The only thing you could do is not allow somebody to claim over $600. That would be the only way to prevent them from playing. And legally, I don't know if we can do that or not. But right now, there's no self-exclusion. The casinos will have that, but the lottery just with 7,400 retailers, how do you enforce that?
Yeah.
What's that thing you just said, Paul, before you continue? Right. We're not hanging up on you.
Okay.
Say the point again, that one thing you could do is limit the amount of the prize? That
well, no, what happens is anytime you win over $600, you have to come to one of our lottery offices. So if you were on a self-exclusion list and you won over $600, you couldn't cash. That's about the only way we could do it. Other than that, we just can't enforce it
Understood.
At this point.
Paul, though, on the phone, do you have another question, or is that do it for you?
Yes. How about people on welfare, EBT, that kind of thing? If we have them in a database already known by the state that these are people that we're handing them money, can't we put them on a list that they can't claim prizes?
I don't know if legally you could do that. That's the problem. People have a right to play. We cannot deny them. We don't know where their money is coming from. They may have money from other sources that we don't know about. So to deny them being able to claim, I would believe, is illegal at this point.
Paul, thank you for your call, and thanks for your nice, kind words. We appreciate it.
We're talking with Paul Sternberg, who's the executive director of the Massachusetts State Lottery. You know, I wondered something else. Say you get really lucky and you win $50 million. Do you have to go down and have your picture taken with a check so everybody in your neighborhood and all your relatives and family be after you? Or can you just secretly send your lawyer and go get the prize?
If it's Mega Millions or Powerball, you have to claim.
Mm-hmm.
And people want to see who
won. In person.
In person. They want to make sure that somebody actually won.
Yep.
And it's very important for the integrity of the game. Other games, other games you could collect in a trust at a lesser amount. But anything, the multi-state games, you have to show your ID.
So within Massachusetts, we could send down our lawyer.
If you did, if you won megabucks or okay. you won an instant ticket for $10 million, you could claim it in a trust.
We're talking to Paul Sternberg, and now we're talking to Chris in Newton, who is on with Paul Sternberg from the lottery. Hi, Chris.
Good afternoon, everyone. Paul, why are so many lottery players so philosophically opposed to depositing their losing scratch tickets in the trash?
Oh, I'm so with you, Chris. Go ahead. Continue. I love this. Go ahead.
That's a great – I mean, I'll
is there any chance of redoing the recycling program you had where I can't remember how many tickets it was, but you bring back 100 losing tickets and you get a free ticket or something like that, because it's just amazing how infested the streets are infested with discarded tickets, and usually within about 10 or 15 feet of an actual trash receptacle.
Right, and it's very frustrating, and it's a great point. And I will comment that you look down on the ground, and my name is on the back of the ticket, so they say people are walking all over me. But,
but the thing that Chris mentioned, wasn't there a program before where you collected, like you said, X number of tickets and return them, and you get some?
I was actually there when that program was in place, and the legislature had allotted $100,000 for a recycling program. That program, its intentions were great, but it ended up costing the lottery probably $2.5 to $3 million. So it was outside the scope of what we were allowed to do. We are actually exploring. We do second chance drawings now. So if you have a non-winning ticket on certain games, you can mail it in or enter it online, and that takes it off the streets. We're looking at expanding that, maybe having drawings at the end of the year. We're also looking at a points program, much like S&H Green Stamps, where you would go online. We're looking at different options. And when we move into the new technology with the new system, our capabilities will go up greatly. But that is a huge problem. You think people would throw it out, and they don't, and it's very frustrating.
You do have a great story, though, Paul, about someone who did put their lottery ticket in the trash.
Tell
people that story. This is a great story.
And that happened probably about 2 or 3 weeks ago when the gentleman threw his ticket out, and he hadn't played it, and he went back in and dug out the ticket and realized he had thrown it out. And he dug the ticket out, and he scratched it, and it was $1 million winner.
Yeah, he dug it out of the trash. Yeah. I mean, that's a really common thing. You come home from the grocery store, you leave things like your wallet, I've done that, in the bags from the grocery store, or your credit card or something. And then, they actually retrieved it. It would have been a difficult marital situation, I think, if the wife had lost the ticket.
Yeah, and that actually made national news. I mean, everybody picked up on that. It's a great story, and people do throw out winners all the time. And that's the other problem. People actually go into the trash pulling tickets out to see if there are winners, because there are winners in there.
I was going to bring up that one. Yeah. I threw out one last week. How do I get my money?
That's a great question.
No, seriously. That's why we invited you on. I threw out this huge ticket.
Someone saw you in this alley, the back of Inman Square, scrounging around you. It was very embarrassing.
That's the voice of Paul Sternberg. He's the executive director of Lottery. He's going to stay with us a little while longer. We're going to take a really brief break and then back with your calls right here on Boston Public Radio.
When it comes to innovation, Seth Godin has some radical ideas.
The problem is we have not taught our kids to fail.
I'm Kara Miller. This week on Innovation Hub, a fascinating conversation with best-selling author Seth Godin. He'll shake us up with ideas about the future of education, risk-taking, and our changing economy. Tonight at 9 on 89.7 WGBH.
This program is made possible thanks to you and to Cordova Sculpture Park and Museum in Lincoln, Mass. 30 acres of contemporary art set in an idyllic outdoor landscape, plus constantly changing exhibitions in the galleries. Open every day this summer. decordova.org. And Northeastern University, where researchers are creating sophisticated computer programs to put the world's cyber criminals out of business. Learn how Northeastern is making tomorrow happen at northeastern.edu/tomorrow.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. This is Ask Thee, and today's Ask Thee is the executive director of the lottery, Paul Sternberg. He wanted to go, but Marjorie had more questions about standing in line behind an older woman who is buying 400 lottery tickets, so we decided we'd keep him. He'll take your calls, and he's taking our questions at 877-301-8970.
You're always claiming you're standing behind old women who are buying cat food as well. I think you're making that up.
I've had this conversation with Paul, and I'm sure you get it all the time. I mean, the only reason I have a problem with this, because my attitude is if you want to bet your money, you can bet your money, is a lot of people who are really down on their luck are people who are hoping, I'm going to hit it, whether it's at a casino in Connecticut or it's buying an extra lottery ticket. I mean, it is hope for people.
Yeah.
What are the odds, for example, of the Powerball? What were the odds last night of winning any, let's say, one of the big prizes, not the $200 million, but the or $400 million, but winning even $1 million. What were the odds, roughly?
Probably 1 in 12 million off the top of my head.
1 in 12 million.
Yeah. And, okay, so, and it could be off a little. It's
well,
off
the top, yeah. A little. I don't think it makes a hell of
so
a lot
what,
of difference.
Jim? Jim wants to take away their hope.
Okay.
He wants to take away their hope. Lots of people think, you know, they're in a crummy job or they're not in a job or they're, you know, they can't pay the bills. It's hopeful they go spend $5 and think, gee, maybe I'll get lucky.
Somebody has to win.
Somebody does win. And you know what's great about the lotteries in general all across the country? Usually it's, you know, seven guys that were working in a factory together and they all pooled their money. Or it's you mostly see people that are you know, working paycheck to paycheck and winning. And it's great.
But you do also see, by the way, this is not good cop, bad cop, where she praises the lottery and I trash you, Paul Sternberg. When you see these movies about people who've won X million, this has nothing to do with you, X millions of dollars. Who had no idea how to deal with money?
Yeah.
The relatives, shysters, all these people, and they're in worse shape post having won a couple of million bucks than they are. That's an interesting question. Before we get back to the calls, is any counseling, either financial or otherwise, offered to big winners by the lottery?
We recommend they see a financial advisor, but we can't give any advice ourselves. So we.
But you do say that they should sit down with somebody.
We recommend that they should definitely go in before you come in to claim a prize like that. Go speak to a financial person. Speak to your lawyer. We had a gentleman today who won megabucks for just over $7 million. It was a Fall River police officer.
Good for
and
him.
And he went and he came. Took 2-3 weeks to come in. He came in with his lawyer. He, you know, his plans for his money. And it was a great story. He's been on the force for 28 years. So that's the great part of the
job. Guy's an unbelievable job. I'm thinking, if you're a dentist, almost everybody goes to the dentist because they're suffering and they're miserable. The only reason anybody goes to see this guy is because they're going to collect
$7
million.
And now we know we can go secretly, Jim, should we ever get lucky.
Let's go to Joan in Fall River. You're on with Paul Sternberg. He is the executive director of the Massachusetts State Lottery. Hi, Joan.
Hey, hi. How are you?
Great.
Excellent.
I've been wanting to ask this question for a very long time. I'm so glad you have this program on.
Great.
When the lottery gets high, very, very high, like say the Powerball was 400 and something million, why don't they draw more numbers, making more winners? I mean, if 20 numbers were drawn at, you know, $400 million, there'd be 20 people with $20 million
spending
more money.
Yeah, that's a great question.
You know, and that's I've asked that question all the time. And part of the problem is people don't play until the jackpots get up to $300-$500 million.
You're looking at one. I'm serious. You're looking at one right now.
And I said to you, would you like to win $20 million in $40 million in Powerball, because that's what it goes back to when it's reset. People won't play until that jackpot gets to that huge level. And unfortunately, so if you were to split up all those prizes, you wouldn't get the play that you get. I mean,
yeah, but let me do a corollary to what Joan said. Even, Joan, how about this idea? Even if you don't split up the big prize, you expand the pool of second-tier prizes so that there the 400 and whatever million last night goes, I guess it went to three people who bought tickets.
Right.
But instead of, I don't know how many million dollar winners are, let's assume they're what, they're 20 or something?
I think around 35.
35. Let it be 300. Let them be, you know, and make the prize a little smaller. I think you're onto something, Joan, and we'll push it with the executive director here. Thanks for the thanks. Everybody, that's one of the things. Right. Also, everybody has an idea how to improve the lottery. Right? You
no
deal
question.
With this every day?
Yeah, but we get a lot of great ideas that come from research focus groups, being on the radio. And the suggestion you just made with Lucky for Life, which is an in-state game, it's a New England game of the six New England states. The top prize is $1,000 a day for the rest of your life if you win. We took a look at that. We went out and did research. We are now adding in September a second tier, which is $25,000 a year for life. So we're expecting to have more winners, because you usually have between 50 and 70 people who win that. And the top prize, you probably have three or four. So we're looking for ways to do that. And that's something that our research told us.
I've told Marjorie the story many times. I don't know if I've ever told it on the air. I had a friend who, when I was president of the union that represented legal services people around the country, we had national meetings. We had one in New York quarterly. Yeah. And this woman who was a paralegal in the Pittsburgh office, she and her partner, you've heard this, I'm sure, a million times, would buy a lottery ticket every single week. This is maybe 20 years ago. She was coming to New York City for the meeting. She got to New York. You know, you realize what the end of the story is already. She calls her partner and says, oh, I really feel horrible. I got on the plane. I forgot to buy the ticket. You know, no big deal. And she left the message for her partner who didn't get it. Later that day, her partner leaves her a message saying, Tony, we won $1 million based on the same number they'd been playing. And $1 million was something, man. And of course, the end of the story was that she didn't buy the ticket. And she said to me, I spoke to her about 10 years later. This is a horrible end to the story. I shouldn't have told it. She said, and this is a totally upbeat, wonderful woman. She said there was not one day in her life since that day that the first thought she has had when she woke up is how she blew the $1 million.
I mean, that's a tough way to live. And the person who won, actually, the police officer who won, he had a season ticket, so he made sure that didn't happen. And when he actually won, the quick story he said was he called home. He was on vacation. He called his son. He said, look at the numbers on the refrigerator, make sure I'm correct. And he said, well, that ticket's expired, the season ticket. But they had the new one they just hadn't put up on the refrigerator. So he was driving home, you know, and his son called and said, I found it. But that's, you know, so.
Can you imagine? Yes. That would be awful. Yes. That would be awful.
Paul Sternberg, before we get back to a couple more. When did lottery start in the 70s? Is that right?
Actually, New Hampshire started in the 60s, but Mass started in 72.
And basically the notion, and I hate to put a negative spin on it, but I'll do it again. I mean, this was – legislators are able to say, we're not raising your taxes to help cities and towns. This is a voluntary, in quotes, activity. And you're given $1 billion, the city or town. So it allows sort of tax-phobic legislators to embrace something that raises a lot of money.
Right.
Okay, fine. I just want to make sure we're on the same track. Let's go to – no, I mean, it is what it is. I mean, let's go to Arlington.
It's hopes and dreams, Jim.
Well, the
hopes
guy is obviously doing a very good job. It's doing a return on a ton of dough, a huge percentage. It's just I'm not crazy about the concept, but we have the concept, and he's doing it well.
Mary from Arlington, what do you want to ask about the lottery?
Hi. How are you today?
Oh.
Oops.
Who's on also? Is that you? Who's on besides Mary?
We have two people.
Well, whatever.
I'm on.
You're Mary. You take it away, and then we'll figure out who else is there. Hi, Mary.
Okay. When the lottery first came out, I remember a friend saying to me that they thought that the people who started the lottery thought it would cut into the profits of the number game. But it, I guess it's proving that people are playing the lottery and the numbers. So
you mean illegal numbers. Is that what you mean?
Yeah, the numbers racket.
Yeah, okay.
But people are still playing it as much as they used to. So what does the lottery have to say with that? That was one of the reasons why the lottery got in the game in the first place.
Great question, Mary. How about a poll?
I have no stats on that because I can't tell you what is illegally wagered, but I can tell you our numbers game is the third highest in our portfolio, doing around $350 million, very popular, been around for years. And I know initially it did make a dent in the numbers games, and that's from listen to historical perspectives when they started the lottery. But I can't tell you if it's still going on or it's not. That would be more of a law enforcement question.
Hey, Mary, thanks for the call. Is the return on an illegal numbers ticket higher than your return?
I honestly couldn't tell you because I never played, so I don't know.
But wouldn't that have to be – I mean, if the goal was to undo the numbers racket, as Mary said, then the way to do it is to provide a better return for the people who play numbers, right?
If they win, they're not paying taxes.
That is a very fine point.
The Whitey Bulger trial. They could have answered all those questions for you, Jeff.
That is a fine point. Remember, Whitey won the lottery. We talked to Joe Malone a few weeks ago, former treasurer.
That's right.
Another nice guy,
was it $1.7 million shortly after Malone took over?
Right.
And didn't want to give him the money.
No.
And he got a call from a staff member of Whitey's. Brother, Bill. Yeah. Let's take one or two more, Marguerite.
John from Arlington. What do you think, John?
Hi, how are you?
Good.
Great.
Good. I have an idea. Just I mentioned it because at Christmas time, I always wanted to buy some tickets for friends and relatives and all, but you hate to disappoint people with a lot. So I was wondering if they ever had an idea of like buying a $10 ticket with a guaranteed minimum, like even if it's just $1 or $2, they win something. So just at Christmas time, you have a special gift lottery so that you know that they're going to win something, even if it's just a buck.
You're a genius, John.
That's a great deal.
And in theory, it sounds great, but they actually did one ticket like that. If you invested $5 or $10 and you won $2 or $3, the players were irate.
What were they irate about?
That they didn't win their initial investment. So they were very upset about it. They thought, if you're going to win on a ticket, and we have this point now where if you play a $10 ticket and you win $10, people complain. I say, you got to play for free and you have another chance to play if you'd like to. But when you give back less than the value of the ticket, people get very upset over that.
John, thanks. I thought it was a great idea. Yeah. Paul, what's the most common complaint you get? What's the most common problem you have to deal with from customers?
Not enough winners. And as I said, we paid out almost 73 cents in the dollar last year. We went the highest payout in the country. We probably created every week we create about 3 to 3.5 millionaires a week. So, but that's the biggest complaint. There aren't enough winners. And if you do focus groups and you watch the heavy players, or people who play a lot will say, you pay out 30 or 40%. They don't even realize that we pay out 73%.
How many machines? You said there's 7,340 dealers? Not dealers.
Almost 7,500. So we have probably about 8,000 of the blue terminals out there called ISIS.
And I assume you do an analysis. And, well, I assume it evens out over time. My guess is that there are certain that just – by chance, produce more winners than others. Is that not a fair statement?
It's kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy. If you have a lucky store and you sold a winner, people go there now to play more, so they're buying more tickets.
Oh,
so you're
really?
Going to have more winners. Just if you're selling more tickets, the odds are you have a chance of having more winning tickets. Ted's Mobile does very well, and they do $15 million in sales.
Where are they?
They're right on the New Hampshire border.
$15 million
in
sales?
It's a gas station, and it also sells lottery and Keno. They do a great job.
And how much do they make on 50? I understand they get a part of – on an average year, assuming they have an average number of winners, how much of the $15 million bucks do they get?
They make 5.7% basically, so somewhere around
– almost $800,000?
Between $800,000 and a million with bonuses.
So the theory is that people are coming over from New Hampshire to play the Massachusetts lottery? Is that what the theory is?
Yeah, or on their way home, they're playing it because our payout is probably 10 to 15%. You know, they're probably instant tickets are the low 60s overall. We're at 73, so it's a different. It's
if Marjorie and I wanted a lottery machine installed in the studio, what would we have to do?
You need to pass a credit check, a criminal records check.
Make sure
there are no other machines in the building because we don't want cannibalized sales. We want value added. So. But you can think about it.
Now, is there a Lucky Store closer to Boston that we maybe could drive over to after the show?
There are a lot of Lucky Stores. I just look for stores that do high volume.
Okay.
So,
hey,
yes.
Paul Sternberger.
That's 7-Eleven I go to. It's very high volume.
If people have questions or want to email you, how do they get in touch with you in the lottery?
At psternberg@masslottery.com, and that's STERNBURG. Or just go to our website. We have a webmaster. We answer every question.
What's
we
the website?
The website is masslottery.com.
So if you weren't the head of the lottery, would you be gambling?
Would I be gambling?
Yeah.
I probably would play.
Yeah.
I mean,
do you ever go down, like, are you allowed to go to Foxwoods?
I'm allowed to go
Sun?
To Foxwoods and Mohegan. I don't play as much as I used to.
Yeah.
If I'm in another state, I will actually buy a lottery ticket, a scratch ticket to see, just to get the feel of it, but I'm not allowed to play in
What's
Massachusetts.
What's the most you ever won on a lottery ticket in another state?
Actually, $200 in Michigan I won,
whoa.
Believe it or not.
I heard you were really something at the blackjack table. Is that true?
I know better.
Paul Sternberg, yes. It's really good to see you. Thanks so much for your time. We appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, Paul Sternberg is the executive director of the Massachusetts State Lottery. I'm all excited. I usually don't play that much, but now I'm kind of geared up to get out there.
I can see the excitement in your face.
And spend some money on the lottery. Okay, when we come back, there is this fantastic new documentary called 20 Feet from Stardom, a film that looks like at the careers and lives and profound influence that backup singers have had on music with the Rolling Stones and Sting and Bruce Springsteen and a lot of other great performers. Joining us to elaborate on that film is our accidental film critic, Christopher Lydon.
It started as a joke almost, something that's going to get us moving before we go to work.
Two athletes dreamed up an exercise program. Now hundreds of others have joined them.
I want you to turn to someone you don't know, say, I'm glad you're here, and give them a big bear hug. Do that now, please.
Muscle building and community building with global ambitions. The November Project, next time on The World from PRI.
This afternoon at 3, here on 89.7 WGBH.
This program is on WGBH thanks to you and the Massachusetts Teachers Association, reminding you that learning doesn't just happen in the classroom. It happens all day, every day. Working together, parents and teachers can make this a successful school year for every child in Massachusetts. And Washington Week, the latest addition to WGBH's public affairs lineup. Friday nights, join Gwen Ifill and kick off an evening of lively debate and fresh insights. That's Fridays starting at 8 on WGBH 44.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Backup singers have largely been the unsung heroes and heroines of some of our greatest songs. That was until the great movie 20 Feet from Stardom hit the big screen.
My greatest pleasure is to stand back and let them do what they can do.
When you're a backup singer, it is a springboard, but it can easily become quicksand if that's not what you want to do.
there's no guarantees in entertainment.
I've got dreams.
Rough dreams.
I felt like if I just gave my heart to what I was doing, I would automatically be a star.
Gives me chills. I'll tell you, that was from the new documentary, 20 Feet from Stardom. All three of us have seen it. A film that looks at the careers, the lives, the profound influence that backup singers have had on great music. Joining us to elaborate is our accidental film critic, the man behind RadioOpenSource.org. That'd be Christopher Lydon. Hey there, Chris.
Good day, Jim. Good day, Marjorie. And I was just struck a moment ago by this is a theme we've done a number of weeks. The truth of the culture comes out in the arts. Ruskin said this in the 19th century. Nations, great nations, leave their autobiographies in three scripts. There's a sort of won and lost record in war and peace and leadership and blah, blah, blah. And then there are the monuments like the pyramids or whatever. And then there's the arts. His point was that only the arts don't lie. To me, this movie is an incredible history of our times. And the result, amazingly, we got to talk about this, is these spectacular women. Every one of them articulate, beautiful, approaching their 70s, content in a certain way. They've struggled. Some of them have won bigger than others. But these were women you want to know. These are deeply humane, human, you know.
But they were great.
Beings. As you said, laugh, cry, jump up. Cheer them on.
We're going to play you a lot of music, by the way, from the film. And for those who haven't seen it, I mean, Chris and I have described it a little. Essentially, you hear from both the singing voice and the spoken voice of a whole spectrum of backup singers on songs that are amongst your favorites. And it's interspersed with people who are not 20 feet from stardom, but who are on the front of the stage. People like Sting, Stevie Wonder, Bruce Springsteen.
Who married a backup singer.
That's a very good, Patti Scialfa. That's a very fine point. You know, there's so many takeaways from this movie.
Innumerable.
The one thing that I will never forget is this woman, Mary Clayton, tells a story about being summoned to a recording studio in the middle of the night. She's in her curlers. I think she was pregnant.
Yeah.
Her agent calls and says, you got to come do this thing. And, when I first heard her, I thought she was making up the story. But then they flash to Mick Jagger, who's also interviewed. And Mick Jagger says, we're about to do this song. They call this woman who shows up in her curlers and her pajamas.
Hold on. She says, is some group the Stones?
That's exactly right.
Or something. I'm not sure. And yeah, she came with the spoolies and her little kerchief over her head.
Her name is Mary Clayton, and the song is Gimme Shelter. Can we play a couple of seconds of Mary Clayton doing a little riff here that everybody knows?
She said, rape, murder.
Those lyrics? But, in the trailer moment we heard, she was the one with a voice sort of breaking with heartbreak who said, she just assumed that her talent and hard work would make her automatically a star. She didn't get to the front of the stage, as Bruce said. It's a long walk. But what a woman. What a woman. Another thing just to throw in. These are women, as far as can be, from the, shall we say, the Billie Holiday or the Whitney Houston picture of the broken women or the alcoholics or
druggies, drug addicts
of showbiz. These were all powerfully healthy, interesting, three-dimensional, assertive, as I said, articulate people. You'd love to keep the conversation going with all of them.
And also deeply religious. I mean, they were all people that came up in the church.
Absolutely.
And the Jesus theme was, repeated over and over and over.
That's another, so many takeaways, as Jim says, but this paradox that most of them, or a number of them, were children of ministers.
Yes.
And they all grew up in singing in the black church. And yet, as somebody said very, very wisely, there's a terrific transformation here. They're playing a role that the choir plays with in the sort of call and response with a preacher. And yet, Ike Turner or Ray Charles, for that matter, has also turned it all around. It's all about sex. And Ike Turner was sort of pimping his girls.
Yeah.
And yet, to me, that's part of the beautiful, all-human embrace of this movie. Church stays in it, and sex stays in it. And there's that marvelous woman at the end. Her name is Mabel John, who had been a Raylette. And we all know how girls got to be a Ray Lett, but she's become a churchwoman again.
Preacher.
How
did
they get to become a Ray Lett, Christopher Lydon?
Well, the legend. You let Ray. I mean, there was no secret about that. But there she is singing that wonderful song. Oh, God. I've sung it myself so many times.
We'll think of it.
This is the day that the Lord hath made.
Oh, yes.
And teaching that and preaching that and talking about what comes through in the end of these very, very full lives is an intense love of the music, and a sense of the gift.
Yep.
Which has all sorts of religious implications, but
you got to use it.
She's a devout woman.
You got to use it. You got to use the gift that you got. It's a gift you got. And you know
our
what?
Number. Let me give our number out because we'd like people to join us. It's 877-301-8970. You can fall into one of several categories. If you saw the movie and would like to comment, we'd love to talk to you. If you are a backup singer, we'd love to talk to you. Or if you, like I, before this movie, think you really appreciated the role that backup singers play in some of the most incredible music we've heard, many of whom are totally anonymous, at least until this film. Give us a buzz, 877-301-8970. I'm sorry, Marjorie, interrupted.
No, I was going to say, I thought the most fascinating biography was about Darlene Love, who was probably the best known of all these singers, that she was in, and I, until I saw this movie, had no idea. She was a backup in He's a Rebel, that great, He's a Rebel, Monster Mash, y'all remember that, That's Life. And then, but she was working for Phil Spector, who, of course, is now doing time for second-degree murder, and he would not let her free from her contracts with him. He did terrible things vis-a-vis Darlene Love. Do you remember what those were, if not?
Well, he ripped off her voice.
Yeah, he ripped
off
her voice.
And labeled it with something else. I mean, this was a very exploitive industry, and there we have racism, sexism, just plain stealing in broad daylight. And yet, and this is a woman who ended up cleaning houses in California to tide her over some bad years. That's another thing. We don't hear in this movie exactly what they were paid.
We don't.
That's
we
a very good point.
How that played out. But Darlene Love also, she was a star in Lethal Weapon with Danny Glover and Mel Gibson. She sang with Tom Jones, virtually these wonderful duets. But she was on...
She was on David Letterman a bunch of times singing the Christmas song.
Yeah. This one. She wrote the Christmas song, in effect. Again, she would be my model of the robust, absolute completeness of this whole experience. She was not defeated by Phil Spector.
No.
I mean, Phil Spector.
But she also ultimately got the recognition that virtually none of the rest have. In this movie is a great scene where Bette Midler is reading. She's her introducer, and she inducts her into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame,
right,
which none of these other backup singers have ever been lucky enough for.
The great story about Darlene Love is that she's cleaning houses, as Christopher just said, and she hears her song, Christmas Baby, Please Come Home, the song that she later sang with David Letterman. She saw it as a sign. What am I doing with my life? Why am I cleaning houses when I have this wonderful instrument of a voice? And she threw herself back into the music. And as you said, too, it was so clear, and I think this is true of every musician, the passion for the music that they felt. And this was their whole – I mean, they had to sing. They had to make music. You felt that, too, as exploitative as the
– No, you feel the vocation. You feel the dedication. You feel the blessing for all of them in what they're doing. We got to talk about Lisa Fisher, too.
And before we do, since we mentioned Darlene Love, let's hear a second of her. Here's Darlene Love singing He's a Rebel.
To the way he walks down the street, that's the way he shuffles his feet. My ho is head up high when he goes walking by. He's my guy. When he holds my hand, I'm so proud.
Waiting for the chorus. How great. Oh, man. It is. We're talking about
great.
20 Feet from Stardom with Christopher Lydon. If you've seen it, give us a buzz. Or if you just love backup singers, give us a buzz as well. Carmen in the car, you're on with Jim, Marjorie, and Christopher Lydon. Hey there, Carmen.
Hi there. Carmen loved the movie.
We love Carmen. Can we say that?
Yes, we know Carmen. But Love the Movie was particularly appreciative because just observing over the years how these popular pop culture icons always gravitate towards the black sound, and that was long unrecognized. And so it was particularly gratifying to see that talent, that tradition, that gift, as you put it, recognized in the film.
Carmen, that's a wonderful point, and I was about to try to say something like it. It's so ironic the way the racial card gets played back and forth. At one point, when they're doing in the Perry Como era, one of the girls says, you know, we had to learn to sound white. And then comes the moment when Joe Cocker is trying to incorporate this sound, and they use these backup singers to sound, for the Brits especially, to sound black.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Indeed. I'm reminded the Waters family that was featured in that are particularly close to my family, and I can remember what's the Sweet Caroline guy?
Oh, Neil Diamond.
Neil Diamond, yeah.
Neil Diamond, and they were back up for him on tour for years and years, and may still be as far as I know, but the way the sound and the voice is played out for the Neil Diamonds of the world, the Tony Orlando and Dawn for the Graceland guy.
Elvis.
The Graceland guy.
Elvis Presley.
Hey, Carmen, we know who you are, and we are thrilled to have you call.
Can
Carmen,
I just say one thing? I mean, we know she co-anchored the 10 o'clock news with...
With who? With you? Moi. Yes, exactly.
but not everybody knows that Carmen Fields comes of the first musical family of Tulsa, Oklahoma. Ernie Fields was the Count Basie of his time.
Really?
In Tulsa, absolutely. And Carmen's brother is a musician, and she knows the music.
Carmen, we love you. Thanks so much for the call. You know, Carmen mentioned the Waters family, and the beautiful, when they are speaking, not only singing, there are three siblings sitting around a table in their house somewhere in California, just talking about everybody with whom they perform. Here is Michael Jackson's Wanna Be Startin' Somethin'. I love this song with the Waters family on backup. Here it is. Oh, I'm sorry. We had the Jackson song with the Waters family. Here it comes.
Talking, and all of a sudden they'd break into song, and they'd all have these perfect harmonies right around the table there in the kitchen. And they were older, of course, because a lot of this music was made in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, and there they were with these great voices well into their senior citizen years. It was fantastic. But talk about Lisa Fisher, because she was a great story, too, and a great backup.
She is, of all of them, the one I knew least about, but the one I carry away. I mean, I got to tell you there's a connection here. I came out of the theater, first time I saw it, and a woman in the parking lot said, Christopher Lydon, I just want to thank you. I said, for what? She said, for Johnny Hodges. She heard us talking about Johnny Hodges in this show.
That's great.
But Lisa Fisher reminds me of Johnny Hodges, that tone, that woman. I love the sections, long sections, where she's just kind of vocalizing by herself, listening to the sound, experimenting, stretching the sound, playing with the sound, high, low, raspy, smooth. I mean, she has one of the incredible musical instruments in herself.
I agree with every single word you said. You knew the least about her. I knew nothing about her. I'd never, even though I know now that I've heard her sing many a time. She's been with the Rolling Stones essentially for the last quarter of a century.
They never tour without her, apparently.
But when you hear this woman sing, particularly when she sings with no background music, there's a great scene where the producer or the director of the film is introducing the film, I think for one of its first, for one of its premieres, and he says to this audience, there may be 200 people in the room, you'll hear the story of the film, and now you're going to hear from a woman you've never heard of her before, and here she is, Lisa Fisher, and she gets polite applause because people are being nice, and she stands on the stage and says, I'm not really sure what I'm going to sing. I want to feel what's in the room. And then she just starts singing, and you've never heard, as you said, Chris, this instrument effortlessly is just unbelievable. Here she is, by the way, Lisa Fisher singing Papa Was a Rolling Stone. Here she is.
Said Papa would beg, borrow, and steal to pay his bills. Folks say Papa was never much on thinking. Spend most of his time chasing women and drinking. Mama, I'm depending on you. Tell me the truth.
So why was she a backup singer her whole life as opposed to making it out into the solo life?
Because I think in some fashion she chose it. She found later in her maturity that she had chosen it. It worked for her.
Yeah.
Again, that was, to me, one of these stories of the varieties of life and the varieties of ways to be a human being. She puzzles at the end, wait a sec, should I have grandchildren by now? Should I have a husband and a home? Is there something lonely here? And she sort of says, no, that's the way I was supposed to be. But also, she didn't want that long and as Bruce Springsteen says, rather tricky walk to the front. She found something she did supremely well. And in her business, she's a legend and totally respected. And she liked it.
But there are a lot of women.
Mary Clayton was sort of eating her heart out. And Darlene Love
saying, why am I not on the front of the stage?
Yeah, exactly.
I always believed that if I worked hard with this voice, I'd be up there where those
right.
men are singing
those
songs.
Well, that was the great little monologue Sting did when he talked about how, you know, it's
Sting was a star for me.
He was great.
So much better than Mick. I mean,
well, he's a much more thoughtful guy, I think, in these kinds of situations than Mick Jagger, at least for my money. And he talked about how it's just a confluence of things, you know, great luck, great timing, having the right label.
Circumstances,
yes,
he said, yeah.
Circumstances. And I think that was so true because you do think there are so many people, there are so many musicians that are so talented. And so few actually make it, you know.
But to me, the question was, wait a second, Gunther Schuller thought that Sarah Vaughan was the most important sort of instrumental voice of the 20th century. How do we compare Sarah Vaughan, who could do everything, with Lisa Fisher? I wouldn't worry. Could Lisa Fisher have been the greatest singer, the bigger instrument? But I did think part of the beauty of it was she did find herself. I want to say one other thing about the sort of, for me, the big sort of moral takeaway of the movie for about the country in general. I think we love to think that this country is capable of infinite transformation and recoveries. We blunder. We blunder through slavery. We blunder through things like Vietnam, but we find our way. I don't want to, you know, we worry about that today, but you watch this movie and you say, God almighty, for all our sins, something incredibly rich comes out of all of this, as we say, racism, exploitation, reversals, ripoffs, injustices of theater, stars getting so much excessive credit and money and stuff. And yet, the picture for me of Lisa Fisher was of enormously rounded, complete, interesting, full life in person.
Yeah. Yeah, so, but the one transition that I think we have to embrace is there are, well, people like who? Beyonce and others like her would probably have been 20 feet from stardom 20 years ago or 30 years ago as these women are. There are black women now who aren't 20 feet from anything. They're at the front of the stage, and it's backup singers who are with them. Chris and Natick, you're on with Christopher Lydon, Jim Browdy, and Marjorie Egan. We're talking about 20 feet from stardom. Hi, Chris.
Hey, I haven't seen the movie yet. It's on my list, and I definitely want to make it. But
run,
I didn't want to
walk, Chris.
I did want to chime in about Mary Clayton. She's a favorite of mine. And what I've heard a few discussions of the film, but nobody's ever really mentioned her solo career. She put out a fantastic debut LP, which was Gimme Shelter. She did her own version of the song. Mm-hmm. She did a Simon and Garfunkel cover. She did a Doors cover. But some great original stuff as well, and her voice is just amazing. She put out, I think, 5 or 6 LPs. She never really found great commercial success as an individual artist, but she cracked the top 100 a few times. And, of course, she recorded a version of the song Lift Every Voice and Sing, sort of a black rights anthem that was a fantastic version. So I DJ and I play her out when I'm doing Soul Fest, and a lot of people don't know her because she just never really made it that big, but her solo stuff is just amazing. It's fantastic stuff.
And by the way, if people just tuned in, Mary Clayton is the woman we're talking about, who in the film was either lying in bed or some such thing, gets a call from her agent saying there's this group called the Rolling Stones who'd like you to sing some backup. She's in her curler. She's pregnant. She goes down to the studio, and she's the voice that is this iconic voice on Gimme Shelter. Hey, Chris, thank you for
Chris,
the call.
Chris, thank
we
you. She also transformed that song, Sweet Home Alabama.
Leonard Skinner.
Right, and she rebelled at the thought of a sentimental song about Alabama, and this was probably the 60s, 70s, and but she said, we'll do it our way. And she says in the movie, we're going to sing the crap out of you.
And by the way, the reason for that, the significance, is Lynyrd Skynyrd's Sweet Home Alabama was believed to be a response to Neil Young's Southern Man, which obviously was a condemnation of much of the South. And Lynyrd Skynyrd's song was a celebration of the South. So she's in some sort of angst as to whether or not, as a black
exactly.
woman, she should participate in it. But as you said, she decided to take a route.
You know what was one of the depressing things that they talked about at the end of this documentary is that this does not really happen anymore with these backup singers because everything is computerized. I wasn't really clear about what they were talking about.
Well, auto-tuning and terrifically synthesized sound,
right?
Digitized everything. It was sad. And the fact that this is a profession that's almost disappeared. At the same time, we got to also mention Judith Hill.
Yeah. She was great.
Enormously gifted young woman who's sort of torn. She was a backup singer with Michael Jackson. She would have been in
the tour that never happened.
Developed. Yeah. And she's still sort of betwixt and between, doesn't she say? Background can be, you know, quicksand or a springboard, and she's not sure for herself.
Well, she says there was a period of time, I think post-Jackson's death, where she wouldn't take backup singing jobs anymore. She decided she just was going to focus on being at the front of the stage, and then ultimately, if I remember correctly, she broke down and did do some. But she is this prodigious talent, beautiful woman, and essentially is the 21st century version of a lot of these women who came before.
Last, just one local note. I was fascinated. I looked up this wonderful woman, Janice Pendarvis, who speaks at the start of the movie about the significance of these lives and these roles. It turns out she teaches singing at the Berklee College of Music.
Is that so?
Yeah. So next program you want to do with Janice Pendarvis. I'd love to know more.
Rolf from Marblehead, you are on with me and Jim and Christopher Lydon.
Hi, Rolf.
Yeah, hi, guys. My name's Rolf. I was a roadie for a lot of the big bands, people like the Stones and Bowie. Back in the late 70s and the 80s. And it's a very rigorous lifestyle. There was the act you're working for, and you got to know the band. But for the most part, they were the heroes. They were into their own lives, and we were doing our jobs for them. But the backup singers and the backup musicians tended to live a much more casual life and seemed to enjoy the work more. And it was just a lot of fun for a road engineer in those days. They sort of, at least for me, they became the part of the act that I would bond with because of the effusiveness that they tended to have. You might, if you had some time in the afternoon, you all might take a walk somewhere and just, talk about things.
What did they talk about, Rolf? And I'm dying to know who in their own biz they truly admired and respected.
Gosh. Well, first of all, I have to qualify this. At my age, a lot of the nuances of those memories are gone. But in particular, for instance, there's a black man who was the backup singer, and I still see him on TV for James Taylor. And he still backs up for James. I think it was Plant.
Lufrid Vandross started out as a backup
singer.
I learned
in the movie
yesterday.
Forgot, Rolf.
And you tend to find, actually, that what would the things we would talk about would be the things that would take us outside of the rigors of the road or the rigors of the show. You're not talking queuing, or you're not talking an effect that's not working, or which tended to happen with the band themselves. you're just enjoying what a beautiful day, or the fact that the arena is right on the water on the coast somewhere, or and the other part of it is it takes, when you're a road engineer, it's easy to get into that sex, drugs, and rock and roll psychology. And that wasn't me. I was more of a nerd. But and so they were people you could connect with that weren't that.
Got it. Hey, Rolf, you're a great storyteller.
That's why you're still here, Rolf. Yeah. It sounds like Tata Rolf, Vega, thanks. who sort of got...
Yes.
She got sidelined out of a great career. But she said, on the other hand, if I'd made it, I might have OD'd. I might not be in this movie.
Yeah, she did. She was a great singer too. Let's take a couple more calls here. Paul from Milton. What do you think, Paul?
Hi.
Hi.
A point of reference: Judith Hill was one of the finalists this year on American Idol.
She was. I didn't know that.
And I think she's going on. She must be. I think she's one of the few. One of the 5 or 10 finalists. Probably going on tour with them.
Wow. Who beat her?
I have.
Somebody that was deserved to be there?
She was good. I can't remember her name.
Yeah.
Paul, did you see the movie yet?
No, I haven't.
Yeah, you love it.
You really, as Chris said, run, don't walk. It is really extraordinary. It is.
But she was really a real talent, and it showed, and she should have won. But I think she was older than the others, and...
By the way, for those who don't know, Judith Hill is not old. She may be older than the other. She's maybe, 30 years old or something?
Oh, I doubt it. 22,
she's
maybe.
Clearly got a future ahead of her in a totally different time than the Darlene Loves and the Mary Claytons and those sort of people. Paul, thanks for the call.
Well, I thought some of it was, although a lot of these women were good-looking, there's such a visual aspect now to movies. To singing. Everybody's got their videos and all that. And certainly Beyonce is one gorgeous-looking woman. And Mariah Carey is a pretty good-looking woman, too. This young woman is also a good-looking woman. I think that you can't be an unattractive woman, I don't think, in 2013 and make it big in – I often wonder if Bonnie Raitt, who's pretty but not a knockout, would have made it if she was starting today in 2011. I don't know. Or Aretha Franklin, for that matter.
Yeah. Judith Hill, let's root for her and remember her.
Let's take one last one. Fred, you're in Arlington. You're on with Jim and Marjorie and Chris Lydon on Boston Public Radio. Hey, Fred.
Hi, great show. I live in Arlington, and I'm fortunate that I can get to places like Temple Cinema and Coolidge Corner to see this movie.
Yes.
And I did see it, and I loved it. But I really feel bad for all the people who probably will never see it because it doesn't show up anywhere where they live.
That's
but,
true.
Also, one of the points I wanted to make was, it was made in the movie, I thought that was really interesting, was that there wasn't a whole lot of resentment or really, negative feelings among these women, although there was some, and it was justified. But they pointed at Aretha Franklin as sort of the chosen one back then, for whom all the good songwriters were writing songs, to the exclusion of, a lot of other people who may have had equal or perhaps even better talent, although God knows Aretha's a terrific singer. But that was an interesting point, the way the music business sort of channeled it all her way.
Yeah, an interesting point. Aretha sort of comes across as a heavy in this spectrum.
Right.
Who was it? Claudia Lanier, maybe, who...
Another who spent a lot of years with the Rolling Stones, Claudia Lanier.
But also had she might have been an alternative Aretha, but there's only one slot for that role.
Julie just emailed and said that Judith Hill was actually on The Voice and lost to a 16-year-old country singer. I do not know because I didn't see The Voice or the American
Judith Hill is 29, Chelsea tells us. So I think she has a couple of years left before. Hey, Chris Lydon, we are thrilled not only you were here, but that you were wise enough to tell us to go see this movie.
I think it was one of the great experiences.
Oh,
what
I
music
loved it.
Are we going to go out on here, colleagues?
Okay.
This is Mary Clayton's solo of Gimme Shelter. When we come back, talk about from the sublime to the ridiculous. We're going to talk about non-seasonal things that ruin the
right.
season we're in.
Yeah, exactly. Well, it's Hollywood. Halloween is the end of October, and already the candy corn is in the store. And if you've been by many stores lately, you know that winter clothes are in the stores as well. I would like to enjoy summertime while it's summertime. We're going to talk about that, getting rushed by retail, up next on Boston Public Radio.
That's great. Thanks.
I'm Liz Alessi. I live in Cambridge, and I report here. I've just always been a really curious person. A lot of the more interesting stories that I've found have been things that I just stumble upon because they're issues that I hear people talking about and asking questions about, and I have those questions
really
too.
I think that if patients know better why they're taking their medications, they're more apt
My
to
job
take
is
them,
to do the digging and find out more about that. Liz Alessi, WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
We love our contributors. That means you. And Bentley, the Mafra Trom Bead Project for at-risk children in Ghana, is anything but typical. It's part of a social enterprise designed and implemented by a group of students from Bentley University. Bentley, the business university. And the Boston Speaker Series, presented by Lesley University, offering 7 evenings at Symphony Hall with a lineup of speakers that includes a prime minister, a Pulitzer Prize winner, a humorist, and even a former spy. BostonSpeakerSeries.org.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. You'll have to bear with us for a few minutes. Something is driving us out of our you-know-what, so we figured we'd share it with you. It's August, correct? Candy corn is on shelves everywhere. Isn't Halloween in late October? And come September, if past years are any guide, it'll be Christmas carols 24/7 on every radio station and elevator. And we want to ask you at 877-301-8970, aren't we being robbed? Can't we experience the present before we are deluged with the future? 877-301-8970. Will came in the other day and mentioned that in some store he had seen candy corn. It's
Kmart.
August. So
Kmart?
August, September, October. We have 3 months. It was at Shaw's. 3 months we have until Halloween. We could wait probably till post-Labor Day, can we not? You mentioned a couple of seconds ago all this back to summer starts, and already there's back-to-school clothing.
Well, the fall clothes. You see the fall clothes in the stores where you have the wool things and the long skirts and the long sleeves and everything else. It's depressing because you feel like, gee, you know, I know it's August, but there are still a few weeks, and we're not at Labor Day yet, and why do we have to start talking about the wool clothes now? And if you go to buy something, I remember this a couple of years ago. I tried to buy badminton. I used to take my vacations in August, and we used to go buy a badminton set for my kids every year, because kids like to play badminton. And I would go, like at the beginning of my vacation, August 1st, whenever it was, and I could never find any badminton sets because they were all sold out.
You got to buy them in February.
You got to buy them Memorial Day weekend when you're out of luck.
877-301-8970. Is there a sign of this that drives you as crazy as it drives us? The worst by far is Christmas. I happen to love Christmas, but there is nothing worse than seeing ornaments and Christmas trees and Christmas music being played everywhere you go in September. It's just, and it creeps up. I mean, everyone knows Christmas, when I was younger, obviously by definition I was younger at this time, Christmas started the day after Thanksgiving. We didn't have Black Friday. We didn't have any of that stuff. After Thanksgiving, and you sort of say it's less than a month, you get in the spirit, it's okay. Now it is as soon as one season starts, we start marketing the next season. And it's horrible.
Well,
you really feel cheated.
And you also feel pressure to start preparing. You know, because of Black Friday, you almost have to debate every Thanksgiving. Am I somehow remiss in my Christmas shopping if I don't leap up from the Thanksgiving table?
In the middle of the night.
Before I've even finished my dessert, to go out and get in line at Best Buy so I can get the best deals on the TV sets, the electronics.
But it's even worse than that. You sort of feel, when Will described the situation with the candy corn, you sort of get anxious about trick-or-treating. 2.5 months before you have to be anxious about it. You really want to enjoy the heat, the summer, the joy of being in my opinion, the best season of the year. But whatever it is, a wonderful season of the year. But you can't do it because marketers, retailers are marketing something that isn't quite upon us.
Does candy corn get stale, do you think?
No, it's like Peeps. It's like Peeps. It's the only thing with a longer shelf life than nuclear waste. It's candy corn, cockroaches, and Peeps are the three.
I just don't know. I guess you have to have a big house. I mean, why would you load up on the candy corn now and have it hanging around the house from
now
until...
You want to be prepared. Well, I don't think it's going to get... You say it's going to be unusable in 3 months? No, I don't think so.
No, I just wonder.
I think the question is it going to be unusable in 300 years? And the answer is no. 877-301-8970. Give us an example of this kind of thing that really puts you over the edge? Or maybe it doesn't. Maybe you I assume they wouldn't put this stuff on the shelves. They wouldn't be playing Christmas music early if most people, despite our experience, didn't love it. I mean, obviously, if there was a negative reaction, they wouldn't do it, correct?
I guess so, yeah. And you find if you go into stores and you want to buy, like I said, if you're going on vacation at the end of the summer, which some people do, they want to go buy, maybe they want to buy a new bathing suit. Or maybe they want to buy a pair of sandals.
No.
And you're basically talking, unless you have a weird size shoe or something, you're going to be out a size foot, you're going to be out of luck because the size 8s and size 7s are going to be all gone.
Javier, you're in Rhode Island. You're on with Jim and Marjorie on Boston Public Radio. Hey there.
Hey, Jim and Marjorie. Good to hear from you guys. I worked retail for about 9 years,
yeah.
And the kids would get out of school at the end of June.
Yeah.
We would have back-to-school stuff in our stores, on our shelves, ready to go and be bought and be sold the week of July 4th.
A week after they get out of school.
A week after they got out of school, the back-to-school stuff is on the shelves, ready to be bought.
But, Javier, I'm really glad you called. They wouldn't put it on the shelves unless people bought it. And
parents were lining up, shelling out all this the money to purchase these items. And, you know, their kids had the latest and the greatest because they got it first. You know, on the first day of school, as opposed to everyone who does the mad rush at the end of August.
Well, it's because nobody lives in the moment. Javier, thanks for your contribution. It's totally true. It's nobody can live in the moment. And by the way,
You're living in the moment.
What? I am right now. I am. I want to luxuriate in the heat of summer
okay.
rather than deal with the candy corn
the
of October.
Mindfulness approach to
radio.
Do you
eat candy corn,
hosting.
By the way?
No, I don't like candy corn.
Deadly.
Not at all. I can't stand it.
It's got a consistency.
I don't like Peeps either.
Peeps the worst.
Oh.
You ever put them in a microwave?
No.
Put them in a microwave for 30 seconds. You'll be clean enough for years. Let's go to Sheila and Nate at Connects with Jim and Marjorie. We're talking about this. Well, you know what we're talking about. Hi, Sheila.
Hi. Actually, Peeps and candy corn, they're really only good for decorations for things you see on Pinterest. And they're great decorations, but I don't know anybody who eats them.
Well, actually, I have a close friend who thinks Peeps are one of the 7 major food groups. But go ahead, Sheila.
Yeah, Sandy just emailed in that she really likes to eat candy corn, too. So there you go.
Well, I just wait a month. But go ahead, Sheila.
I'm actually calling about Christmas and Christmas songs because when I was growing up, you'd hear Christmas songs on the radio December 25th, and that's it. Nothing
yeah.
else. And then they started doing it a little sooner, which was nice. Now it's December 1st, 24/7. All that you can't get away from it. You get sick of it. And I love Christmas. I celebrate Christmas. I'm a Christian. I've written Christmas songs that people have sung, and I hate
Oh, wow.
this. I hate this because you can't get away. You don't get a chance to breathe. You hear this, shut off the radio.
Hey, Sheila, do us a favor. Stay on hold for a second. Leave your phone number. If you have a Christmas song you've written that somebody said, we'd like to hold on to it for the real season, then we'll invite you back. Is that a deal?
Boy, that's a deal.
Stick around, Sheila. Don't go
okay.
away. Let's go. Andy.
Aren't there a couple of radio stations that start Christmas in Boston?
One was
songs.
In our former building.
Yes.
And by the way, a wildly successful radio station.
But it's way before Thanksgiving.
Way before Thanksgiving.
When do they start?
When do they start
Halloween?
Christmas music? February. They start. They just
they start
around Labor Day or so. I don't know what it, but it's wildly successful because people, other than the caller and you and I, everybody wants it. Andy on the road. You're on with Jim and Marjorie. Hi.
Hi, it drives me crazy too, but I also get to see it from both sides. I used to own a retail store,
yeah.
And let me tell you, one thing that I learned is that if you can get somebody to spend their money now, chances are you can get them to spend it again and again, and you mark it early. I would put out winter gloves in September. Oh, what a great idea. I'll be ready for winter. I'll have my gloves, but then they forget that they bought the gloves already. And, like, you know, but personally, I'm out there in the stores December 22nd just trying to figure out what my Christmas list is, and that's when I start my Christmas shopping. So,
obviously, you're not a good American, Andy. What can I say?
I know. I'm terrible. I end up where Marjorie is looking for stuff in season at the moment that I want it instead of 3 months ahead of time.
You know, Andy, though, you said something that is so true. I remember Walgreens would sell those little cotton gloves for the kids, the stretchy gloves, and they were really cheap, like $1 for a pair of gloves, and you always lose your gloves. I would go in, I'd buy like 30 pairs of these gloves for $30, and I would feel so proud of myself. But you buy them so far in advance, you're right. Where did I put the gloves? Where are the gloves? You can't find the gloves. And then you have to go back and buy some more. You're absolutely right.
Andy, can you meet me after the show? We'll go buy our Christmas trees. Are you available?
Absolutely. Let's do it.
I'll see you at 2:00. Andy, thank you. so much for the call. That didn't make me feel any better. That was, the goal was, but we didn't quite get there. Thanks so much for your non-soothing participation in the show.
Okay. Up next, Caramilla is going to join us. I can't wait to hear about this. Something called perceptive radio. I don't know what it is, but she's going to explain it. And also about the third industrial revolution is coming. Caramilla up next on 89.7 Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I am Jim Browdy. She is still Marjorie Egan. You know, with renewable energy and advances in internet technology, a third industrial revolution could be on the horizon. Kara Miller, who you know is host of the Innovation Hub, joins us to expand on this idea. But first, Kara, I can't wait for this. I'm with Marjorie. We're going to talk about something that you taught us about, revolutionary in its own right. It's perceptive radio. What is that? I never heard the term. I never heard of what it is. Until we read your stuff this morning. What is this?
Yeah, great. It's totally new. So the BBC, we talked to a technologist for the BBC. This is probably the first prototype of its kind in the world. And the idea is, okay, so we're familiar with, you know, you're going to the store and, let's say you're going on the internet, right? And you're checking out Amazon and you're buying, you know, black pants. You're buying, you know, your jumbo box of candy corn,
that's
whatever.
That's right.
And soon you start seeing ads everywhere when you go to other sites for black pants and candy corn, right? I mean, it follows you around. They know what you're looking for. You're looking for a new car. All of a sudden you start. The BBC has developed a prototype of a radio that can tell things about you, the listener, and tailor the broadcast to you. Isn't that fascinating?
I got this idea from the NSA, obviously.
Yes, exactly.
Give us an example of how this would...
Did I tell you that Ed Snowden is the chief technologist?
So how would it work? Give a couple of examples.
Okay, so they get the info from you a couple different ways. One is if you're listening online, a lot of people listen online now, right? Download podcasts from their iPhone, that kind of thing. They can get all the information about you, what you've been Googling, that sort of stuff. So they can get information about you from your Facebook page and whatever. The other thing is they're starting to install on these radios, on these prototype radios, which have not been distributed yet, but work, little microphones so they can tell where you are. So, for example, if you're listening to the car versus listening to a radio program while you're working out, they can actually remix the show for you so that it's best while you're in the car with the background noise of the car, best while you're listening, while you're doing the treadmill, that kind of thing. It's pretty interesting.
And they can figure out. I mean, if they have a locator function, as you describe, and they know that the place where you are, it is pouring, they can adjust what they're doing to incorporate a rainy theme into the mix.
They actually took this live and did it with a BBC radio broadcast of what they would call a football match, what we'd call a soccer match. And people around the country could actually choose what side of the stadium they wanted to sit on.
Wow.
Great. And so you were sitting, even your home, you were sitting with your fans. And so the people around you were saying the kind of things that if you were there, you'd be hearing. Isn't that interesting?
That is incredible.
And you could do so there's two levels of things. One was that. The other one was you could adjust commentary. You could do the like commentary heavy approach, or you could do the commentary light approach. And some people love commentary, some people really hate it.
But with basically the same content, we should be clear. It's the same basic program, which is adapted to where you are, who you are, what you're doing, and what your interests are.
You're saying, like, I want to sit with the Jets fans. Yeah. Like, that's what I want to do.
Right. Same game, same story, same whatever, just with these little accommodations on the margins.
So you'd be surrounded by fans that would be yelling obscenities at the other team.
Yeah, exactly.
Wow, that is amazing.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah, but how do they do this, though? I mean, I get if they could figure out, you know, where you are, it's raining and all that.
Right.
But you'd have to have someone there sitting there in real time. Wouldn't you readjusting?
So they actually have microphones all over the stadium. So basically you're saying, I want this feed versus this feed. So instead of – the way we do radio now is that – there's a way that radio is mixed, right? There's your voices, there's the music, there's one product, and it goes out there to everybody, and it's the same.
Right.
But what if your voice and the music and other elements, they could all be switched around a little bit? They were all individual elements. So somebody could say, yeah, I really like Boston Public Radio, but I like it with less sports. And so, you know, and the computer knew something was tagged sports. And so those things were stripped out every time that person, you know, I don't like sports, but I really like politics. So you got like the politics heavy BPR mix or the sports heavy BPR. Isn't that interesting?
That's yeah, we could do,
so yeah. Watch out.
Here's an adaptation of this, Margaret. We could have one broadcast on a ballot question that says we're voting for it. And another, there's so much that you describe to us every week, Kara, that while I don't understand the technology until you explain it, then I sort of understand it. As soon as you describe it, you say to yourself, of course, it makes total sense to adapt something to what people's likes are and needs and interests. It's so obvious. And obviously the technology is there to adapt almost anything to it.
Yeah, I was going to say it's already there in some sense. People already live in this reality. So if you log on to Google every morning, people can set up their Google homepage
right, exactly.
So that what they get every morning is sports stories. But other people aren't the least bit interested in sports stories. So they're getting, if they want to, the weather in Jakarta every morning. Like you get whatever you want, right?
So this is already happening on a small level.
On a very trial level, the BBC has made it work. So, and so that's what we talked to the technologist of the BBC who developed this.
So when do you think this could be happening, you know, on a grand scale?
I don't know. But, you know, I said to him, one of my questions was, no, I know the BBC isn't commercial, but do you think they're interested in this in commercial radio? And he was like, yeah, I'm pretty sure they are.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, how exciting is it to advertisers to have a sense of where the person is, you know, that this person is this kind of thing, you know, likes politics but not sports? Well, you wouldn't, instead of just throwing your one advertisement out there and just hoping that it hits the right people, you know it's going to hit
the
right people.
On
the
other hand, I'm arguing against myself at the same time, too, because what do you call it, a satellite radio that you get in your car where you can choose 9 million different stations?
Sirius XM.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And you can have, if you're a Bruce Springsteen fan
right.
or you're a Mozart fan or whatever, right. you could. So that's in some sense, is already happening. In that way, it's different than what you're talking about because it's not raining or snowing.
Yeah, but the basic concept here, I don't see the value so much in that, is the narrow thing. You mentioned advertisers. Forget BBC. How about the advertisers on commercial radio? It's not just these are New Englanders, but within New Englanders, well, let's adapt this particular advertising ultimately to the guy who's in the middle of a rainstorm. Let's say at Pep Boys, our ad should be about windshield wipers rather than something else. I mean, you can
Absolutely.
Literally adapt
and
your
also,
ads to whoever the individual listener is
and
eventually,
also,
or viewer.
It wouldn't make that much sense to advertise windshield wipers on a day nobody's using them.
Exactly.
Right? But you could go real heavy on the days that people are like, these windshield wipers are junk. Like, I really need to get new ones. I wonder what ones I should get. Right? And then you
no,
really
but the
do.
Point, it's really clear. I mean, imagine just for a second. I mentioned Home Depot. It sells 4 million things. And if they are able to collect this data, advertisers are, through this technology, ultimately, in addition to the core generic ad, they advertise to you whatever they know you're interested in under these – it's unbelievable, the
yeah.
potential.
Yeah.
It's also frightening.
I mean, I was going to say, I mean, it's frightening, and I actually did talk a little bit to the guy from the BBC about everybody living in their own realities. And he said – I mean, right? You're sitting with
yeah.
the sports team that you like, and so everybody around you is like, what is wrong with that ref? Do you know what I mean? And you don't realize that the people on the other side are like, that guy's a genius, you know? And one of the things he said to me, which was depressing but true, is – you know, aren't people already living in their own reality? I mean, don't we already watch Fox News if we you know, really like the Republican Party? Don't we already watch MSNBC
yeah.
If we think that, you know, the people
Well, that's what
she
was saying
Republican
about, you were
jersey.
Saying about Sirius XM. But this seems to me to be a far finer tuning
yeah.
of the message than the big picture. What you're describing and what Marjorie just described is a big picture shift. You go to the big thing that you like, the politics of MSNBC or Fox News, the Bruce Springsteen versus, whatever, swing music
mm-hmm.
from the early part of the last century. To be able to adapt a basic message or a basic program is huge, but it also gets back to what we talked to you and others, this intrusiveness thing. Now, obviously,
yeah.
it's a voluntary thing. They don't understand. I assume they don't. BBC, they don't find out things about you unless you want them to. Is that correct or is that not correct?
Not yet, but I almost guarantee you there will be a time, the way that we have it now with other technological devices, where you are able to buy a perceptive radio. And the trade-off is tailored programming that you like better than what's on sort of the one-size-fits-all radio. And what do you give up? Privacy.
Do you hit, by the way, a variation on this that is really scary is Mike Capuano, the congressman, was on with us a couple of weeks ago. I don't know if you know about this bill he has. It's called We Are Watching You.
The bill.
He's filed with a Republican congressman from North Carolina, Walter Jones is his name. There is technology where a patent has been requested, where through the cable box, and I'm getting this close to right, they not only will know, obviously, what you're watching. They have the potential to put a microphone. They can view you sitting on your if you are canoodling was the term they used in the story from the Associated Press. They will put up an ad for Viagra or an ad for a trip to a romantic resort. I mean, so again, and that's really scary. And he's doing a bill that says you either have to opt into the system, and even if you do opt into the system, the bottom of the screen will say, "We are watching you."
Should you worry if you start seeing advertisements for like discount lawyers for divorce?
Well, no, but that's right. Exactly the kind of thing
that's
he was
right.
talking about.
Because the television has seen your spouse doing
that's
something
right.
untoward.
Exactly.
And
or that you fight all the time, and they're like, "Well, this can't be going anywhere good."
Hey, yeah. You know, even though I'm obsessed with this perceptive radio thing, we only have a few minutes. Talk about briefly about this third industrial revolution thing and what you're doing about it, Caramella.
Yeah, so we're talking to Jeremy Rifkin, who is the advisor to the European Union this Saturday. And one of the things he talks about is sort of that we're reaching this turning point in terms of the way that we collect energy. And, you know, a few months ago, there was a piece in the New York Times about China. Beijing regularly gets to 40 times the level of deadly pollutants in the air as is allowed. People are leaving China.
Yeah.
Expatriates who are offered a ton of money to go work in Beijing are turning it down.
There are times in Beijing, I've been there a few times, there are times you literally can almost not see across the street.
Yeah, yeah.
It is so thick. But go ahead.
I mean, people are choosing their kids' schools mm-hmm. based on, you know, will pay any amount of money based on the air filtration system they have. You would think, like, the test scores or whatever. And so what he's really talking about is moving into this third industrial revolution. And one of the things we're seeing in Germany is they're already getting more than 20% of their renewable energy, of their energy in total in the country, from the sun. They're headed
from the sun?
Yeah.
How much?
And Germany's not even very bright.
What's the percentage?
22%.
Wow. That's
amazing. Actually. And they'll be, by 2020, in 7 years, they'll be at 35%. So Germany's one of the world leaders here. And he really is talking about a third industrial revolution where, here, we were just talking about online and how things are changing. Where he's talking about sort of the destruction of the big oil companies and the big coal companies and the big natural gas companies, where a few people make a ton of money from exploiting things, and that we may be entering an era in which we all essentially are living in little power plants, right? Because we have solar energy on our roof and that kind of thing. The amazing thing he said is that in 45 minutes, enough sunlight falls on the earth to power the earth for an entire year. We just don't capture it.
As I believe Marjorie's mouth is wide open for those who are not in the studio with us.
That's another thing we could add to radio.
Yeah,
but you
that's
know what the problem
right,
is?
The Marjorie cam.
Maybe Western Europe is embracing this more heavily, but obviously what we hear a lot about in this country is the horrible investment that Barack Obama made, the horrible investment that Deval Patrick made, where the government lost, you know, millions, if not hundreds of millions of dollars. Where, despite broad goals, what does Rifkin say about the future of the United States in this direction?
You know, I asked him about that, and he said one of the things he had to say about Obama is he said he was really pretty disappointed. He said he voted for him twice, but the way that he sort of funded individual projects that had sort of no connection. He had sort of no overarching plan and said, okay, here's a solar factory here. But he had no idea how he was going to get from here to there. He was pretty disappointed in that. One of the things he said is that it's much harder in the U.S. to get anywhere because in Europe, elections are publicly financed. Here, they are financed by whoever finances them, and the energy companies are right there. They also, and the energy companies are very good at reaching out to the public. I mean, I don't know if you've you've ever sat
BP,
through.
These ads omnipresent.
You sit through the Sunday shows. Every darn thing is for Chevron and how they are moving to a world beyond oil. But for them, the notion that, you know, you, Marjorie, you, Jim, could have solar panels on your homes, and solar panels have actually gotten tiny now and as thin as paper, some of them, that they you could have those on your homes and be generating your own electricity and not pulling from the grid. Or in some cases, people have so much electricity, they actually sell it back to the grid. But that you could be doing that is actually, of course, very threatening.
Yeah, but why isn't the natural consequence that they'll just buy up all the solar companies?
Once you've bought the solar panel, the sun is free. You don't have to go back to them anymore.
Very good point, Jim.
Thank you. Hey, Karen Miller, what's tonight and what's Saturday, please?
Saturday is Jeremy Rifkin and the technologist for the BBC. And Amanda, what's tonight?
Seth Godin is tonight.
Yeah. Seth Godin, a really good conversation.
Well, at least you know who the producer was to ask. That's a step in the right direction. Karen Miller tonight you're at 9 and Saturday morning at 10, correct?
You got it.
Great. Thanks for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. Tomorrow it's Emily Rooney on Open Mic. Callie Crossley is going to look at a ton of news that didn't get the headline treatment. We're also going to ask her about 20 Feet from Stardom. I am Jim Browdy.
I'm Marjorie Egan.
Thanks so much for being here. We'll see you tomorrow at noon. Bye.